This is Canadian Wealth Wisdom by TriDelta Private Wealth. My name is Kyle Taylor, Wealth Advisor and Portfolio Manager with TriDelta. I am joined by Cameron Windsor, Head of Equities and Portfolio Manager of TriDelta's Growth and Pension Equity Funds. Cam has spent over a decade with TriDelta, but previously worked with Franklin Templeton, RBC, and Scotiabank in a career spanning almost 30 years. Welcome, Cam.
Thanks, Kyle. Good to be here.
Before we begin, it should be noted that this podcast is intended for general information only and not as specific investment advice. You should always speak to an investment professional to determine the appropriateness of any investment or investment strategy and how it relates to your specific situation. That said, the TriDelta team welcomes a conversation to learn more. The purpose of this series will be to discuss recent market developments, what we are watching, and ultimately what action TriDelta is taking within our growth and pension equity strategies. Cam, we've talked in previous recordings about the two primary strategies, and to the end of March, the growth equity fund has returned 5.76% and the pension fund has returned 7.17%, both outpacing major equity indices during the quarter. Can you share a little bit about why?
Sure, Kyle. The answer to how we did versus a benchmark is always twofold. You know, what happened in our funds and also what happened in the benchmark. We'll start with the benchmark. In the S&P 500, which makes up about 40% of our benchmark, the top six names, which make up about 30% of the index, you know, common names like Nvidia, Microsoft, Apple, were down on an average of 10%, causing the mega cap biased index to be down over the quarter while the broader market was actually positive. You know, so this can sometimes be a bit of a double-edged sword, since in the past when these names have outperformed, we've sometimes had a struggle to keep up with the index, especially in the pension fund, which is a little bit more defensive and focused on the companies with higher dividend income streams. But overall, our portfolios here at TriDelta are a little more balanced, tend to be more towards the mid-large cap bias in stocks. And in essence, essentially, we're quite different than the benchmark. In the growth fund, we had a number of names deliver solid performance in Q1, like 5N Plus, a rare earths producer, MKS, a provider to the semiconductor manufacturers, Precision Drilling, an energy services company, and Extendicare, a senior healthcare provider. In the pension fund, some of the drivers were also Extendicare, which we own there, but also Seagate, a computer storage company, Quebecor, a Canadian communications company, Exchange Income, a diversified holding company focused on the airline services, and Bristol Myers, a large pharmaceutical company. So you can see all of these, this broad, diversified portfolio of names, you know, all helped produce some solid performance in Q1.
Obviously, the Iran war was on everyone's minds from late February into April. Surging energy costs have been a concern for investors and obviously a very visible consequence of the conflict for consumers. We're still getting into company earnings reports, but how are you positioned today?
Yeah, so as far as positioning, like in the energy sector to be specific, we've been reducing our energy weight into this spike as we think the initial reaction was a little bit overdone. You know, we've also, on the energy theme, we've added to some names like, say, CNR, which have been negatively impacted by the energy costs. But we think over the longer term, CNR could actually be a beneficiary of Canada's efforts to become a more energy export market, as many countries around the world are looking for more stable geopolitical environments to procure their oil and natural gas from. You know, as far as earnings go, it's still early in the earnings season. U.S. banks have been kind of the big news so far with some solid outperformance. And, you know, we saw some things kind of changing in the market toward the end of Q1 last year. So we were actually adding to our financials positions in pension. We added Stifel Financial Corp, a company focusing on wealth management and investment banking. And we're up around 13% so far in the growth fund on that. And, that was in the pension fund. And in the growth fund, we've added Ameriprise Financial.
You mentioned energy. Are there any lessons learned from past market experiences that maybe we can draw on today?
Yeah, for sure. For a lot of people, spending on energy and transportation, energy for transportation, home heating or cooling can make up a decent percentage of their monthly budget. You know, a 10-20% change in these costs can make consumers feel a little squeezed, causing families to curtail a number of discretionary purposes. Luckily, as a society, we're spending less on energy as a percentage of disposable income. The TriDelta quarterly commentary had some good information showing that consumers now spend about 5.7% of disposable income on energy versus 10% back in 1984. But nonetheless, the bump up in these everyday energy necessities, if dragged on for too long, we could see could have a negative effect on the economy and many consumer discretionary stocks and discretionary spending of consumers.
It's so interesting because during the Q1 commentary when we were writing it, we talked a little bit about how this year feels eerily similar to last year. And the theme really was around the man with the hammer, which references yet another year being characterized by global uncertainty resulting from a U.S. policy decision. How do you go about managing investments during periods where we know volatility is likely to stay?
Yeah, I mean, speaking of hammers and tools, we have a number of tools at our disposal to help manage the risk of the portfolios. You know, the easiest one is usually raising and lowering the cash in the fund. So we had raised up our cash levels when coming into some of this conflict here. We started working that level down probably about a month or so ago. But we also have currency options that we can use to hedge some of our exposure to. We can sometimes sell calls on stocks that we think are a little bit too lofty and helps generate a little bit more income for the portfolio. And if the stock continues to rise, we're just going to be selling at a higher price. We try to monitor the markets and our holdings to be opportunistic. And, sell when things are a little overly exuberant and buy a little when names become too depressed.
You mentioned some of the U.S. financials already, but were there any other opportunities that you picked up on during the quarter?
We've been a little more active recently during the turmoil. We had also mentioned CNR, which was another name that we had picked up. We had talked about Stifel already in the pension fund. On the growth fund, we've shifted the strategy there a bit as it's more of a dynamic type of process and focusing a little bit more on value type names. And recently we've added names like KP Tissue, Canada Packers, which is up actually about 15% for us since we added it, and Align Technologies.
Okay. And, one of the things that we mentioned in the commentary was how this year felt similar to last year. And one of those other pieces has been the AI tech trade and some of the volatility that we've seen in there. And January and February were particularly a phenomenal month for the growth and pension equity funds. These were months that were characterized by pretty sizable declines in software stocks, as investors seem to predict an end to the massively profitable cohort of the market. What's your take on all this in terms of AI and software and the disruption that is entailed? Do we own any notable positions within the funds?
Yeah, the AI trade for sure. It's been quite a roller coaster. As we talked before in our earlier benchmark comments, one of the names was Microsoft software stock, and that was one of the worst performers for the first quarter, down 25%. In the mentioned kind of AI software catastrophe there. I mean, overall, I think AI will lead to a lot of productivity gains at these software developers, and they'll be able to do a lot more with a lot less human capital. So I think some will definitely turn around and be winners, but they'll need to show a significant value add over products that essentially could be created by anyone using some of these brand new amazing AI tools. We don't own any of the software names directly tied to AI development, but we have a number of the, we'll call them picks and shovels companies that AI industry needs. We talked earlier about MKS, you know, being a positive contributor over the last quarter in the growth fund, as they're a key contributor to the semiconductor process, which is much needed for the AI compute power. MKS has they call it a surround the wafer strategy, as they have equipment for etching, deposition, and gas delivery to aid in chip fabricating. You know, we also own Micron, which is a leading semiconductor company in growth. And then in pension, we own Seagate, which is up around 500% for us, as, you know, they provide the data solutions and or data storage solutions. And with more and more data being needed and created, we see storage is still a key market going forward.
It's interesting because there's also a lot of silliness going on in that space. And one of the stories that I've shared with clients occurred in January. It was Algorithm Holdings. I don't know if you've heard of that stock. They're a small Florida-based company. And up until very recently, their core business was selling and manufacturing karaoke machines. And they came out with an AI tool that was apparently disrupting all of the trucking industry. And on one random Friday, the U.S. logistics and trucking companies were down, I think, lost something like $20 billion in market cap. So I think it's a fun example of some of the silliness that goes on and how sometimes you have to go beyond just the headlines. But it's no denying that it'll have an impact on various industries. And I know that's something that you're watching within.
Well, yeah, it just really lays credence to, you know, the disruptiveness that this AI can lead to. Because, you know, the one thing there is that you can basically, you don't have to be a programmer anymore for a lot of these, you know, to go and create something. You just kind of have an idea and have to be able to be good at prompting in the AI universe to make sure it's doing the right things. But you can get a lot of people just creating things on the fly that before they would have never had the capabilities to create.
And it's interesting because even on the software side, it seems like there's this bit of a almost like a paradox, because on one hand you have the AI companies themselves saying, no, these software companies are necessary for our tools and what they're meant for. And then you have the market saying, no, these software companies are going to zero and their profitability is going to be challenged over the foreseeable future. But when I look at, you know, the Microsofts or the Googles, they have such a strong access to capital, both on their own balance sheets and then the ability to raise capital through the debt markets or what have you. They have this track record of being able to grow through this disruption and acquire the smaller guy before he becomes a larger competitor. And it's interesting to me to see that all of a sudden people don't assume that to be the case anymore.
Yeah, no, that can definitely, if you can get people who can scale and create, again, just, you know, all these little guys need so much less capital to create and grow, you know, where before they would have needed the capital to go and hire, you know, 100 different programming software engineers, whatever. And now it could be two guys doing the same as what 10 years ago would have taken an army of 100 software engineers. So
I do sometimes still wonder about what the profitability trends need to be for investors to get kind of less pessimistic, because obviously that was one of the big themes end of last year, early this year, around, yes, stop just telling us how much money you're going to make, actually demonstrate it. And it reminded me when we were doing the commentary around how in 2020 and 2021, Meta, or then Facebook, rebranded to be Meta, and Metaverse was going to be their next big thing. And they were pouring billions of dollars into it. And in 2025, I was surprised to learn that they actually wound up all spending because shareholders effectively got impatient and didn't see the value in it anymore. So I took that as a bit of an interesting case study around companies. If shareholders are loud enough and the market is telling them something, will listen to a degree. And I almost, how, like, it may shape the conversation around some of these AI investments over the next few years.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, there's always going to be the hopes and dreams and the, you know, the blue sky visions of what exactly technology will lead to. Meta Example's a great one. They kind of ran through it. It had its little phase of about a year of, what were those, like, NRT tokens, and there was all this type of...
NFTs.
The NFTs, and then the metaverse, and there was a whole kind of pile on that. But there's hits and misses across every sector, across every, a consumer brand type of thing. So,
but I like your comments around the picks and shovels, because I think some of the, obviously we know the valuations are quite stretched in certain areas, but some of the second, third tier beneficiaries of AI really aren't fully apparent in a lot of respects. So I think that will be an interesting thing to watch moving forward. So thanks again for joining me, Cam. For any listeners who have not already read our Q1 2026 market commentary, I would encourage you to visit the Insights page on our website. That concludes this recording of Canadian Wealth Wisdom, and more specifically, our quarterly market update series.